I want to read to you three stories from the Gospels. And as I do, they're just short stories. I just want to ask you to pay attention as I read. Pay attention to what's happening. Mostly pay attention to Jesus. Even if you want, maybe you want to close your eyes and just listen to the stories, and in your mind's eye, just watch Jesus. Learn from him. Notice what he says. Notice what he does. Notice how people respond to Jesus. Jesus entered Jericho and was passing through. A man was there by the name of Zacchaeus. He was a chief tax collector and was wealthy. He wanted to see who Jesus was, but because he was short, he couldn't see over the crowd. So he ran ahead and he climbed a sycamore fig tree to see him, since Jesus was coming that way. When Jesus reached the spot, he looked up and said to him, "Zacchaeus, come down immediately. I must stay at your house today." So he came down at once and welcomed him gladly. All the people saw this and began to mutter, "He's gone to be the guest of a sinner." But Zacchaeus stood up and said to the Lord, "Look, Lord, here and now I give half of my possessions to the poor. And if I've cheated anybody out of anything, I will pay back four times the amount." Jesus said to him, "Today salvation has come to this house, because this man too is a son of Abraham. For the Son of Man came to seek and save the lost." As Jesus walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," Jesus told him. And Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It's not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I've not come to call the righteous, but sinners." As Jesus was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who had been caught in the act of adultery. They put her in front of the crowd. "Teacher," they said to Jesus, "this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say?" And they were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer, so he stood up again and said, "All right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone." And then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest, until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." Jesus, we read these stories. We watch as you interact with people, imperfect people, just like us. And my simple prayer, Jesus, this morning is that as we talk about this topic that we've entered into here for a few weeks, that we would in some way learn to act and speak and love like you did. And we need help. We need help to know what that is. And so I ask by your Spirit today that you would help us get a little clearer picture of what that looks like. In Jesus' name, amen. The church needs more gay people. What are you feeling right now? When I say that, what goes on inside of you? How does the voice in your heart kind of respond to that? So what I want you to do is just turn to the person beside you and... No, I'm not going to do that to you. I know some of you are getting up to leave. Now, I'm not going to make you tell anyone, so just be honest with yourself. How do you respond to that statement? I ask because I think in a lot of ways, it kind of sets the tone for everything else we do or say about this issue of faith, gender, and sexuality. Because if right out of the gate, if our posture is no, we'd prefer that those people not find their way into our community, then we may as well end the series right here. Because us doubling down on that response will ensure that we're not going to do well on this issue. But if we can start from a place of being able to say, no, you know what? I actually want gay people to show up. I actually want transgendered people to show up. I mean, if we could get ourselves to that place, then I think that attitude lets us at least have a shot at embodying the grace of Jesus towards the LGBTQ plus community. I mean, even if we don't know all the right information, even if we don't have all the answers, if we can at least decide that we want to start with that posture, I think that's a critical first step. We've called this series Embodied in part because we want to wrestle with what it means to live as the embodiment of Jesus towards the LGBTQ plus community. Throughout the Gospels, as we pay attention to Jesus' social interactions, it becomes clear pretty quickly that Jesus is a guy who's hanging out with all kinds of people, all kinds. We just read three stories that give us a window into the kind of people Jesus specifically came to love, not just to love, but to call, to follow him. Broken people, sinful people, marginalized people. He's hanging out with the clean and the unclean, the pure and the impure. Some were befriended, some were confronted. Every one of them was loved. The people who were the most repelled by Jesus seemed to be the religious hypocrites. And yet today it seems far too often that it's the religious people who feel most comfortable hanging around Jesus followers, and it's the LGBTQ plus community who are the ones who feel the most repelled. So what's changed in 2,000 years? Is it that the sinners of today are different than the sinners of Jesus' time? Or is it because we've drifted? Is it because we have not figured out how to have the same posture that Jesus had towards the marginalized and misunderstood and broken and sinful people of our world? Last week we talked about our theological view around sexuality, and if you missed that, I'm not going over that again today. I encourage you to go back and watch that online because it is an important part of this conversation. But today I want us to reflect a little bit on this issue of our posture towards the LGBTQ plus community. Now first, just a real quick word about terminology. When I say LGBTQ plus, that's an acronym that stands for lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or I'll just say trans most often, queer, and the plus stands for all the other words that talk about gender identity and sexual orientation, and there are a lot of them. And if not all of those are 100% clear to you, join the club. The fact of the matter is we could spend these three sermons doing nothing but talking about and defining terms, which unfortunately I don't think would be helpful to us if we can't get to some of the practical pieces. And so I think for our purposes, for what we're trying to do in this short series, it's okay that we don't know all those things. So maybe just as a broad understanding, what I mean when I use that acronym is I'm referring to people who experience gender and sexuality in a way other than a biological male identifying as a male and being oriented to the opposite biological sex, or a biological female identifying as a female and being oriented towards the opposite biological sex. Now, if that's too much of a mouthful for you today, fair enough. Maybe more simply, I would just say that these are people who experience issues of gender and or sexuality differently than what most of us do. I know that's an oversimplification, but maybe that helps you. Now, you know, as much sort of work and reading and stuff as I've done on the issue, I'm no subject matter expert. I come to you as a fellow traveler trying to figure this out the best I can, trying to figure out how to embody Jesus to this community. And so today I'm just going to share with you some of my own processing, some of the stuff that's been going on in my own heart and head, some of the things I'm trying to use as my posture. And I hope that as I share some of these things that you'll find some of them helpful for you as well. I want to start this morning talking about stereotypes. I think that creating and then relying on stereotypes and narrow definitions have not served us well at all in trying to understand issues related to the LGBTQ+ community. Too many of us, having not really done the work to educate ourselves on the issue, we use terms like gay or lesbian or trans almost as though by just labeling someone with that word, we suddenly know everything about them. Right? If we label someone as gay, too often I think it's almost as though by doing that we think we know exactly what that person looks like, we know how they act, we know what they do in the bedroom, we probably even know what they had for breakfast. And that's a really unhelpful approach because we don't know. We don't. There's always far more going on that we don't know than we do know. And so here's one of my convictions. I think we need to commit to moving beyond stereotypes to stories. Move from stereotype to story. Decide that when you're in a situation where you're interacting with a member of the LGBTQ+ community, you're not going to treat them on the basis of a stereotype. You'll actually take the time to get to know their story, to recognize their humanity. We read the account of Zacchaeus off the top, and you know, I think there's a reason that Jesus told Zacchaeus that he was going to come over for dinner. I mean, Jesus could have just stood there and applied the label of tax collector to Zacchaeus and just treated him on the basis of that stereotype. And yet he chooses not to do that. He chooses to spend time with Zacchaeus. He goes to his house, shares a meal. I think of the woman caught in adultery. You know, Jesus doesn't ignore her sin, but Jesus also doesn't simply treat her as though all there is to her is her sin. And instead, he's the one shielding her from those who want to pass judgment on the basis of a stereotype. What does it mean to be gay? If we reduce it simply to meaning to have sex with someone of the same sex, then we have done ourselves and gay people a disservice. There are those who identify as gay who don't have sex with a member of the same sex, just as there are those who identify as being heterosexual who don't have sex with people of the opposite sex, right? Being gay doesn't mean you walk around wanting to have lots of gay sex any more than being straight means that you walk around wanting to have lots of straight sex. Gay more broadly refers to an orientation towards a member of the same sex. Whether a person acts on that or not, it's part of the story you need to get to know. And so can we make it as simple as saying, well, hey, it is a sin to be gay? I don't think so. Because it depends on what a person is doing with that inclination. And I don't know that just by giving them a label. How about transgendered or trans? I think for many of us, the assumption is that a person who identifies as trans is someone who has or is actively in the process of changing their biological sex. Now, you might use the word in that way, but I'm learning that in our world today, people use that word to describe a broad range of experiences that a person might have a person who simply doesn't resonate fully with their biological sex. It covers the spectrum from, on the one hand, people who might spend too much time on YouTube listening to trans activists and deciding they'd like to identify with that minority community, right up to people who can barely get out of bed in the morning without wanting to kill themselves because they feel that severe a level of dysphoria around their sex and gender. And none of that needs to actually include surgery or hormone therapy. That's a whole nother level to the conversation. My point is this. If our only picture of a gay person or a transgendered person is just some stereotype of this individual who, you know, wants to go up to Christians and flaunt it in their faces, you know, if that's the blanket assumption we're going to make about the LGBTQ plus community, then those are probably the only LGBTQ plus people that we'll ever meet. Because who would ever want to confide in us about their real life experience, about their struggles maybe even, if we start the conversation assuming the worst of them at the get-go? Here I think is a good rule of thumb. If you've met one gay person, you've met one gay person. If you've met one trans person, you've met one trans person. And everyone has a different story, and everyone has a different struggle. And relying on stereotypes will do more harm than they will do good. Like a lot of us, Leslie was part of a church family from day one. She couldn't remember there being a time before being aware that she was a dearly loved child of God, and faith was a significant and integral part of her life. But that's not the only thing that Leslie experienced from an early age. Leslie was born female, but experienced life as a boy. She felt like a boy from as early as age 4. Now, as she grew older, her struggle only grew deeper. As the other girls in her youth group at church were emerging from, you know, childhood into womanhood, Leslie just felt no affinity for that journey whatsoever. Leslie had no one to talk to. No safe place to process, so she wrestled by herself. She sank into a deep depression. As she moved into high school and became increasingly despondent and suicidal, she eventually, out of desperation, found the courage to ask her pastor for help. So she went to his office. She shared with him about this dysphoria that she was experiencing, hoping for guidance. And guidance she got. He guided her out the back door of his office and told her never to come back again. And she didn't. She never went back to that church. Finding no love or compassion from Christians, Leslie turned to the one place she could find love and acceptance, the LGBTQ plus community. Many of them had a similar experience to Leslie. Many of their stories included ridicule from Christians. Leslie fell in love with a woman named Sue, and they got married. Sue had a rare disease that caused her hands to shake. One night she went outside trying to light a cigarette. She inadvertently lit herself on fire. Leslie heard the screams, ran outside to see Sue engulfed in flames. Sue was rushed to the hospital, but 3 days later died of her burns. Leslie, in her deep grief, scrambled to make funeral arrangements. After having not set foot in a church for 18 years, she called the church that Sue had once upon a time volunteered at. It happened to be one of the most conservative churches in the area. The pastor picked up the phone, and Leslie stammered, "Hi, my name's Leslie, and my wife just died. We're lesbians, but I want to know if you would do my wife's funeral." And then came the response. "We would be honored to. We would be honored to." And that church surrounded Leslie with love, a love she had never before felt from Christians, a love she had only ever gotten from the LGBTQ plus community. And that embodiment of Christ-like kindness reignited Leslie's childhood passion for Jesus and brought her back to faith. Here's the thing. Leslie still experiences debilitating gender dysphoria to this very day. But she's surrendered it to Jesus. She's chosen a life of celibacy as a way to honor him in the midst of that struggle. She is now part of a ministry that resources church leaders and families around LGBTQ plus community issues all over North America. But Leslie's experience of day-to-day life is still that of an LGBTQ plus person. If we were not to get to know Leslie's story and simply hear that she's an LGBTQ plus person and apply our stereotypes, what would we assume about Leslie? We'd likely assume something about her that is far, far from the truth. And the truth is, Leslie is living a beautiful life of costly discipleship, following Jesus in spite of the dysphoria she experiences every moment of every day. Stereotypes will not do. We need to get to know people's stories. Leslie says now when someone comes up to her, you know, in her ministry and says, "Do you think homosexuality is a sin?" Here's her response. She says, "Well, that's a good question, and I want to answer it. Can I buy you coffee every week for the next 4 weeks so that we can get to know each other first? I want to know your story. I want to tell you my story. And then we can talk about your question." Labels and stereotypes will not lead us to a Christ-like posture towards the LGBTQ plus community. Like Jesus, we have to take the time to treat a person as a person, to know their story. And only then, can we appropriately help and encourage them in what discipleship might look like in their context. Now, the second point, and I've already sort of said it indirectly in that first point, but let me just kind of say it out right now. I think we need to be careful that we not confuse same-sex attraction and same-sex behavior. Let's not confuse same-sex attraction and same-sex behavior. Same-sex behavior is a choice. Same-sex attraction is not. And we all in this room have inclinations that we haven't necessarily chosen. And I think most of us in this room would agree that to condemn someone for an unchosen inclination is not appropriate. Discipleship is not the condemnation of an unchosen inclination. Discipleship is the call to not act on those inclinations when doing so would be contrary to God's will. There's a difference. When Paul lists the fruits of the Spirit, one of the fruits of the Spirit he lists is self-control. By definition, self-control means you have a desire or inclination that you shouldn't choose to act on. So I think as the church, you know, far from condemning a member of the LGBTQ plus community who might have sexual impulses that out of a love for Jesus, they choose not to gratify, those people got to be celebrated. Now, I'm not saying it's wrong to pray for a person who has those inclinations, any more than it would be wrong for a straight guy to pray that he'd never be attracted to anyone else except his wife. But I don't think it's necessary for the inclination to change to be a follower of Jesus. Paul is the guy who talked about a thorn in his flesh in 2 Corinthians 12. Actually, that's the mild version. He follows it up by saying, actually, it's a messenger of Satan sent to torment me. I don't know about you, that sounds really bad, whatever it is. And Paul prays for it to be taken away. But then at some point he stops praying for that as he realizes that God's will for him isn't actually to remove it, but to actually give him sufficient grace to live well, even while all the while he still experiences whatever that is. Because it was in that place of weakness that God's power could be put on display. Far from needing to experience conversion from same-sex inclinations, while not saying it's bad if that happens, living faithfully in God's power while still experiencing those inclinations is actually a beautiful picture of a follower of Jesus. I read a story of a gay Christian who's never engaged in sex. He's been celibate his whole life. And yet, he was honest enough to have a conversation with his elders at his church and share about his same-sex attraction. And the response was, "We can't approve of your lifestyle." His lifestyle? I mean, here's a man who's vulnerably sharing about his struggles, all the while walking a road of sexual purity, and he's being told by the church that they can't approve of his lifestyle. Let's not confuse same-sex attraction and same-sex behavior. Third thing I want to offer today. If you're interacting with an LGBTQ plus person, assume that you bring baggage to the conversation. Just assume that you bring baggage to the conversation. Now, I don't say that because you necessarily have done something wrong. I don't know. But by virtue of being a Christian, this is just a reality, folks. More often than not, as a Christian, you will begin a conversation with an LGBTQ plus person at least 10 steps behind the starting line, simply because there's a good chance that there is some hurt and pain somewhere in their story, and an even better chance that that hurt and pain has something to do with Christians or the church. And because of that, folks, I mean, our language matters, posture matters, words carefully chosen matter. The built-in pain and misunderstanding and anger that might be present before you've even opened your mouth could very well mean that starting a conversation with, "I think you're sinning," actually translates to something more like, "I think you're disgusting and the worst of sinners." That's how they hear it. Preston Sprinkle says that actually, a vast majority of LGBTQ plus people, statistically, were raised in the Christian church at some point. How many of them, do you think, found the church to be the safe place to openly talk about and wrestle with their questions about gender and sexuality? How many do you think? I don't know the number. I feel safe in saying it's pretty low. And so we shouldn't be surprised that 51% of those people have exited the church by the time they reach 18. I'm actually surprised the number isn't higher. And in saying that, look, I'd love to see the day when LGBTQ plus people outside our church could find our church community a safe place to wrestle those issues through. But if you ask me what I think the first step is, I think the first thing is that we need to be committed to being a church that's a safe place for those who are already here wrestling with this issue, either because they have a loved one that's part of the LGBTQ plus community or because it's a personal struggle. Statistically, they're here in this room. This has to be a safe place. If we could get to the place where it's safe for us to have these conversations, like really safe for us, then maybe we could get to the place where we could reach the LGBTQ plus community that's beyond our doors. We've got to start at home, folks. Here's my fourth conviction and my encouragement to you. Our expectations should be appropriate to where a person is at on the discipleship journey. Our expectations need to be appropriate to where a person is at on the discipleship journey. In other words, don't expect someone who hasn't met Jesus to embrace Jesus' values. Don't expect someone who hasn't met Jesus to embrace his values. I mean, if we believe in the gospel, as much as we say we believe in the gospel, if we believe that everything really hinges on Jesus' death and resurrection, then I think we should be far less uptight than we often are as the church about what's going on in the culture around us in regards to issues of sexuality. Folks, we don't live in a Christian nation. We don't have a Christian nation to the south of us either. And I don't mean that just in the sense that, like, now, today, we're not a Christian nation anymore. We never were a Christian nation. They never were a Christian nation. There is no such thing as a Christian nation. Jesus doesn't have a nation that follows borders on a map. He never has and never will. Jesus claims to have a kingdom that ignores borders, that's not about politics. It's a nation that exists where men and women have surrendered to the lordship of Jesus and been made new by his power. To expect our world to embrace and live out Jesus' sexual ethic is actually an affront to the gospel. It's actually an affront to Jesus to say that. Because if we're saying that, we're saying that people within themselves have an ability to embrace the holy, transformed life that God calls us to without first meeting Jesus, without experiencing the work of his Holy Spirit. I mean, if we're saying that, then we don't need the cross. And actually, we don't need Jesus. But we don't believe that, do we? We better not. We believe, because it's what the Bible says, that if you don't have Jesus, you're dead in your trespasses. If you don't have Jesus, you remain a slave to sin. We can't rescue ourselves. It's only in Jesus that a person can actually live out the life of discipleship. And so, folks, on this issue, we need to understand where a person is at. And particularly, if they haven't met Jesus yet, then that's the first step. Not trying to get a person to embrace all our moral and ethical values first, and then we'll introduce you to Jesus. It doesn't work that way. And how can people meet Jesus? How can people meet Jesus if they don't get to hang around and rub shoulders with other people who love Jesus? And that's where I'm trying to say today. You know, as uncomfortable as it may be for some of us, particularly those of us with little exposure to the LGBTQ plus community, folks, we've got to figure out how not just to tolerate members of that community finding their way into our midst. We have to want it. We have to want it in order that they might have the possibility of actually experiencing the love of Jesus through us. We have to want it. Now, I know it's not all as simple as that. I get it. It would be simple, you know, if every person who met Jesus would come to then embrace what we believe the Bible teaches about a sexual ethic. I mean, that would be simple. And that's not the case. So I just need to admit that. And that's where I think, you know, I want to just nuance this conversation a little bit to say that not expecting people who haven't met Jesus to change in their own strength doesn't mean hiding our convictions about this, or about anything else for that matter. I mean, Jesus himself on more than one occasion was clear that if people want to follow him, they should go into that journey with their eyes open. They should count the cost, Jesus said, right up front. They should decide ahead of time if they can really walk the path of discipleship. So to do a bait and switch where we intentionally hide our belief about a sexual ethic, we hide it, we want to make sure they don't know it, get someone all excited about Jesus, and then only afterwards have them find out that we're going to say, well, you know, part of what Jesus is going to call you to is around sexuality. That has done as much harm to LGBTQ plus people as some of the other wrong things the church has done. So I'm not saying we should be dishonest or secretive, but we've got to temper our expectations based on where a person is at on that journey. People can't be transformed without meeting Jesus. That's true of every one of us. And it's true of those in the LGBTQ plus community too. And I think far too often, the church has short-circuited our ability to be in dialogue with the LGBTQ plus community because we've come in, we've started the conversation placing on them the kind of expectations we'd place on someone who's walked with Jesus for a whole bunch of years. We start there with them. And that just kills the conversation. It kills the opportunity to invite them into a life of discipleship. Last thing I want to say. Not rocket science, but we just got to say it out loud. We need to have a genuine posture of love towards the LGBTQ plus community. Like genuine. We have to actually, honestly love these people. Not just say that we do. That doesn't mean we have to abandon the truth. Jesus was full of grace and truth, the Gospels tell us. And if Jesus was able to do it, then his followers should be able to do it too. Jesus is truth, and yet Jesus is not adulterer phobic, tax collector phobic, he's not centurion phobic, he's certainly not homophobic or transphobic. Jesus does not have a prejudice against any human being, and if he did have a prejudice, it would be against judgmental, homophobic, and transphobic religious people. We need, as the church and as Jesus' followers, to put homophobia and transphobia to death. Stab it, kill it, bury it in a grave, and if it tries to resurrect itself, stomp on its head. And I know for some of us, part of the struggle is the thought that, yeah, but what if people misunderstand us? What if they misunderstand, you know, our love and our compassion for actually affirming things like homosexuality? Like, then have we done a disservice to Jesus? If in loving the LGBTQ plus community, that those around us interpret us as being actually lax about sin and lax about holiness. And I would just say, don't carry that responsibility. You're safe to let it go and not lose a minute of sleep over it. Because if that happens, and you know what? It probably will happen, so just expect it. If it happens, we're in good company. Jesus had the same trouble with the religious folk all thinking he was too friendly with sinners, and he obviously didn't take sin seriously. Jesus himself was misunderstood that way, and yet Jesus didn't waste a whole lot of time trying to justify his actions, and Jesus certainly didn't stop loving people. He didn't back away, oh, shoot, I'm being misunderstood. I shouldn't love these people as much. He didn't do that. He just kept right on loving. If people are going to misunderstand us or misjudge us or jump to wrong conclusions about us while we're trying to faithfully embody the love of Jesus towards the LGBTQ plus community, then let them. And just choose to keep embodying love anyways. Let's not be too worried about loving too much, because after all, there's a lot of ground to make up on the issue. A lot of ground we have to make up on the issue. It's going to take a lot of love. It just will. Think of the response that Leslie received that day, that she took a risk, calling on the church for help in a desperate moment. We would be honored to love you. We would be honored to love you. May we find our way to embodying that posture towards the LGBTQ plus community. We would be honored. Honored to love you. Today we're going to finish our time by participating in communion. And, you know, coming to this table is the ultimate reminder to us that there's no place for self-righteousness. There's no place for holy pretension. If you participate in this table, if you do that, you're agreeing that it's only because of Jesus, only because of Jesus, that you have peace with God today. It is by grace you have been saved through faith, and this is not of yourself. It's a gift of God. And specifically this morning, as you participate in this table, I'm asking you to think of what Jesus has done for you, and how you can embody that to the LGBTQ plus community. Romans tells us this, that God demonstrated his love for us in this, that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. And if a holy God, a God without blemish, God without sin, if a holy God was willing to do that for us before we did anything to move his direction, before we had even an ounce of inclination to turn towards him, then how much should we be willing to do the same in demonstrating love to the LGBTQ plus community, even before we would see an ounce of inclination to follow Jesus. Don't wait for that. Love first, because that's what God did for us. I'm going to invite you, as the worship team leads in this next song, as you're able to come on up and to receive the elements, take them back to where you're seated, and afterwards we'll all partake together. And so, God, we sit here in this room as those who, for whatever reason, not because of anything we've done, not because we're better, not for no other reason than because of your grace, we have been those who have had our hearts open to you enough that we would say yes to Jesus. And it really is because of everything you did for us and nothing we did for you. So as we celebrate that today, may it also be a call on us to do the same for our world, to love indiscriminately, to love regardless of whether there's anything in it for us, to love regardless of whether we get anything back in return. Love just because it's what you call us to. So, Jesus, meet us at this table, your table, in these moments.